This is VOA News via remote. I'm Laurel Bowman. Pope Francis continued his historic tour of Iraq and today met with the country's top Shiite cleric. He also visited the birthplace of the prophet Abraham and condemned violence in the name of God. Speaking in Ur, where Abraham was born, the Pope said that the greatest blasphemy is to profane God's name by hating your brothers and sisters. He sat with Muslim, Christian, and Yazidi leaders when he spoke. Hours earlier in Najaf, Francis met Grand Ayatollah Ali al-Sistani. He is one of the most influential figures in Shiite Islam, and their meeting was the first between a pope and such a senior Shiite cleric. After the meeting, Sistani called on world religious leaders to hold great powers to account and for wisdom and sense to prevail over war. He added that Christians should live like all Iraqis in peace and coexistence. Ivory Coast voted on Saturday in a legislative election with President Alassane Ouattara's allies facing a combined challenge from opposition parties led by two of his predecessors. The polls come only months after the president won a third term in an election marred by unrest that killed at least 85 people, the country's worst violence since a civil war in 2010. Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro received a first dose of the Russian Sputnik V vaccine against the coronavirus on Saturday, state television reported. "I'm vaccinated," said Maduro, joking that he should now be able to speak Russian too. In addition to the Russian vaccine, Venezuela is also distributing the Chinese-made Sinopharm vaccine. This is VOA News. U.S. border agents detained nearly 100,000 migrants at the U.S.-Mexico border in February. According to two people familiar with preliminary figures, it's the highest monthly total since a major border surge in mid-2019. The figures show the scope of a growing migrant influx at the southwest border as U.S. President Joe Biden, a Democrat, seeks to roll back some of the restrictive policies of former President Donald Trump, a Republican. February was Biden's first full month in office. Beijing's proposal for Hong Kong electoral reforms could prevent dictatorship of the majority. That's what a pro-Beijing Hong Kong lawmaker said, calling people who want a one-man, one-vote system, quote, politically immature. China's rubber stamp parliament is deliberating plans to overhaul Hong Kong's electoral system to ensure that Beijing loyalists are in charge. Myanmar security forces used tear gas and stun grenades to break up a protest in Yangon on Saturday, just hours after a United Nations special envoy called on the Security Council to take action against the ruling junta for the killings of protesters. The Southeast Asian country has been plunged into turmoil since the military overthrew and detained elected leader Aung San Suu Kyi on February 1st, with daily protests and strikes that have choked business and paralyzed administration. Indian farmers gathered Saturday to block a six-lane expressway outside New Delhi to mark the 100th day of protests against deregulation of agriculture markets. It's to add pressure on Prime Minister Narendra Modi's government. Farmers young and old headed out in cars, trucks, and tractors to the highway for a five-hour roadblock to oppose three farm laws enacted in September 2020. They say hurt them by opening up the agriculture sector to private players. Afghan President Ashraf Ghani said on Saturday in a bid to push forward peace talks with the Taliban that his government was ready to discuss holding fresh elections, insisting that any new government should emerge through the democratic process. Ghani told lawmakers at the opening of a parliament session that, quote, transfer of power through elections is a non-negotiable principle for us. Via remote, Laurel Bowman, VOA News.
From Washington, VOA presents Issues in the News. Welcome to Issues in the News. On the panel this week via Skype, J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times, and our moderator is Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome, everyone. Here are the issues. U.S. lawmakers conducted hearings investigating the January 6th attack on the U.S. Capitol by pro-Trump rioters trying to overturn Joe Biden's election victory. Federal Bureau of Investigations Director Christopher Wray told lawmakers that the attack was in fact domestic terrorism, while some Republican senators continued to push theories about the riots being led by groups opposed to Trump. The United States imposed sanctions to punish Russia for what it describes as Moscow's attempt to poison opposition leader Alexei Navalny with a nerve agent last year. The sanctions against seven senior Russian officials, among them the head of its FSB security service and on 14 entities, marks a sharp departure from former President Donald Trump's reluctance to confront Russian President Vladimir Putin. At least 10 rockets targeted a military base in western Iraq that hosts U.S.-led coalition troops. One American died as a result of the attack. Texas became the biggest U.S. state to lift its mask rule, joining a number of government leaders that loosened COVID-19 restrictions. This despite pleas from health officials not to let their guard down yet. And domestic turmoil rocked several nations, with violent protests continuing in Myanmar, Ethiopia continuing a fierce crackdown in its Tigray region, and China conducting a mass arrest of democracy advocates in Hong Kong. We take a look at these flashpoints and discuss how the Biden administration might respond. Good morning, gentlemen. Thank you so much for joining the panel today. We're going to start off with the Capitol riot hearings as they continued this week with a steady stream of top officials in law enforcement and the military trying to piece together the events before, during, and after the violent insurrection at the Capitol that left five dead. FBI Director Wray told lawmakers that the Bureau did in fact have raw intelligence warning of violence, and lawmakers are now trying to find out what was known, why the intelligence didn't lead to a more prepared force at the Capitol, and what caused the delayed response on the day of the insurrection. I'll go to you first, JJ. What are the officials saying about the intelligence? And can you help us understand this phrase raw intelligence and why it differs from any other type of intelligence and how that might affect the response of law enforcement officials and the military?
Hey, Michael, thank you for doing this, and thanks for the question. I'll start with your second question first. Raw intelligence is basically information, whether it's chatter, whether it's verbal information that's collected or online post or anything that is just taken in its raw form. It's not synthesized. It's not analyzed. It's not essentially vetted. This is just the raw data. And that is something that authorities pointed out very clearly during these hearings that they were getting a lot of in the run-up to January 6th. And that information not being vetted, not being essentially analyzed before it's disseminated, is suspect. So this is a part of what their concern was in being prepared for the 6th of January. They were getting tons of information for weeks and sometimes months before that. But a lot of that information, just the sheer volume of it because of the internet today, just made it really impossible for them to figure out what all of it meant. In terms of what went down on the 6th, according to Chris Wray and Jill Sanborn, both from the FBI, is that they had three different ways of disseminating the intelligence that they disseminated. One was a verbal briefing for all of the key players. Another thing was an email that was sent out to all the stakeholders. And the third thing was there was an online portal through which all of the information could have been viewed and essentially evaluated by the Capitol Police and all of the stakeholders responsible for security on the Hill. So there was some pushback to this idea that the FBI did not provide intelligence. Chris Wray said it was there. The question of whether or why it didn't get to the key stakeholders, he said, I don't have an answer for that.
And Josh, we've talked about Chris Wray, we've talked about Jill Sanborn, the FBI officials who testified. Who were some of the more compelling people who testified this week, and what stood out in your mind as compelling and significant testimony pointing to what happened before, during, and after?
You know, while everyone who saw what happened on January 6th with the invasion of the Capitol realizes that this is a very severe problem and this isn't a problem that's just going to go away, only this week there's another threat to Capitol Hill and lawmakers have moved a vote because they had information from intelligence services that there was another QAnon-linked conspiracy plot and threat to Capitol Hill. So no one's pretending this isn't a very grave issue facing America, but I do think there's a real danger in treating Americans like you would treat Al-Qaeda or ISIS, which is what's being advocated by some on the left right now. And, you know, there's a danger that that deepens divisions in American society and creates larger fissures rather than trying to unify and heal America, which is obviously a difficult task, but that is the message that Joe Biden came into office with and that he has sought to promote, at least with his rhetoric.
It would seem that to get to the truth would be a large part of the healing. That would be the healing salve that you could put on the wounds. And we'll talk a little bit more about getting to the truth and how we actually do that. But JJ, I want to throw to you the testimony that has so far led to some questions about a couple of officials, namely former acting Secretary of Defense Christopher Miller, who's under the Trump administration, and the current Deputy Chief of Staff of the Army, Lieutenant General Charles Flynn, who happens to be the brother of General Mike Flynn, who formerly was in the Obama administration, the Trump administration, and now is sort of a major QAnon believer and figurehead. These people seem to have a very prominent role in what the response was on the day of the insurrection, and specifically the delay that happened between when help was asked for and when help arrived. What do we know about that? And should these people be testifying themselves?
Michael, I'm not sure they won't be testifying, because what you just raised is a very significant question that a lot of people have been thinking about and have been talking about. And some of these names that you've been mentioning, Miller and Flynn, are coming up. There are other names like Wolf, other names like Patel, who've come up as well. And I can tell you from talking to several intelligence and law enforcement officials who are still in place, some people, they say, that were in government on January 6th were deep down the rabbit hole of QAnon conspiracies. And they, in the words of these people that I've been speaking to, are people that are going to have some conversations with some people, going to have to answer some serious questions. Not saying that any of them did anything wrong or illegal, I should say, but I do know this. There are a lot of people on Capitol Hill, a lot of people in the intelligence and law enforcement communities that want to talk to these folks about what was going on in their minds and their heads on this day, specifically those folks that had responsibility for security and could have made calls to, in fact, maybe have brought this situation on Capitol Hill on January 6th under control hours before it did.
So you have the prospect of these groups out there, these sort of amorphous groups that are being brought together either online or in groups somehow, militia groups, this whole just sort of universe of people that feels a certain type of aggression towards the government for one reason or another. And Christopher Wray testified about them months ago. And then you have the possibility of that element within the government. And now you have Republican senators like Ron Johnson of Wisconsin saying that the riots were not run by pro-Trump supporters, and that he even characterized them and read into the record an account that described the day as having a festival atmosphere. How do we get to the truth if we have this turning into such a partisan process where we can't even agree on something that everybody's eyes clearly saw?
What we're seeing from some more pro-Trump Republicans is what you might call whataboutism, where they're seeking not to deny the gravity of what happened, but to muddy the waters and to point out that, yes, maybe there were a couple of people there whose ideologies are so addled that they're both Antifa and pro-Trump or neither. They may have just been anarchists, but pretty clear to anyone who was there, as I was, or who has reported on it, and frankly, who watched it, that this was a pro-Trump protest turned riot. But the hope is that if you can kind of give people enough different pieces of information, if you can stir the pot and muddy the waters to a certain degree, then it just becomes a little bit confusing. You know, JJ's right that the key point here is, or one of the absolute key points, is that 2 to 3 hour gap when really nothing much was done, despite the astonishing images we saw on our TV screens and the astonishing things that were happening in the halls of Congress. And the likelihood is, and this is what this whole thing is pointing at, is that that delay came from the very top. The likelihood is, from the reporting we've seen, that President Trump didn't necessarily want to end what was happening on Capitol Hill, at least not immediately. Now, that is obviously a shocking thing, and it's something we probably want to try and get to the bottom of, but may never do, because, as you point out, there's a lot of partisan politics at play here. There's not a lot of incentive for Republicans to support a very clear and far-reaching investigation. But we already do know a lot, and frankly, in some ways, it's pretty obvious that help was withheld because it didn't arrive for 3 hours. And when it did arrive, that put an end to the matter. You know, we saw National Guard coming in from Maryland and Virginia, and that was the end of the matter. So in some ways, we saw with our own eyes what happened that day.
We certainly did. And I'm going to finish with you, JJ, on this subject. I know that you don't go into the politics on these things when we talk about them, but I will talk about having the truth affect security. How can we keep the nation secure? How can we keep Congress and lawmakers secure when we can't agree on what a threat actually is?
Well, the reality of this, Michael, and that's a great question, but the reality is the people that are charged with protecting and keeping the nation safe, they don't listen to the politicians. They don't answer to the politicians. They answer to essentially their oath of office to protect the nation against all enemies, foreign and domestic. And they have the right, and some on rare occasions have exercised it in the past, to disobey orders that aren't legal, that would put the nation in harm's way. The people who are behind the scenes that actually are responsible for making sure that the U.S. is safe know what they're doing, and they know that they can make the right decisions regardless of what the politics say. There has been some leakage into the process in the last few years. In fact, one particular source that I spoke to said very clearly to me that there were those who wanted to minimize what Congress and what the American people knew about Russia's meddling in the U.S. and anything negative about Russia. They wanted to tamp it down. They also wanted to tamp down anything that had to do with, quote, white supremacists. These are people in the law enforcement and in the intelligence sector, but they were few and far between. The lion's share of people in these communities know that they have a responsibility to keep America safe because America is their home. It's their street. It's their block. It's not just some big country they live in. It's everything and everyone that's in it.
It remains a challenge both to find the truth and to execute safely and democratically these processes that keep us all safe and free. Oh, we will be watching. Let's take a break, and we'll be back with more Issues in the News.
Issues in the News is coming to you from the Voice of America in Washington. If you would like to download the program, it's free on iTunes. Just click on the iTunes tab on our website at voanews.com. While you're there, check out our other programs, Press Conference USA and Encounter. Also visit us on Facebook and leave a comment or two. Then like us at Current Affairs with Carol Castiel. Now back to our panel via Skype. J.J. Green, National Security Correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA. Josh Glancy, Washington Bureau Chief for the Sunday Times. And our moderator, Michael Williams, contributor to CBS Radio in Washington.
Welcome back to Issues in the News. Let's move on to the Navalny sanctions and talk a little bit about Jamal Khashoggi as well. This from a New York Times report. The Biden administration classified an intelligence finding that the FSB, one of Russia's leading intelligence agencies, orchestrated the poisoning of the opposition leader Alexei Navalny and announced its first sanctions against the Russian government for the attack and his imprisonment. The sanctions closely mirrored a series of actions that European nations and Britain took in October and expanded on Monday. Senior officials said the move was part of an effort to show unity in the Biden administration's first confrontations with the government of President Vladimir Putin of Russia. But none of the other sanctions were specifically directed at Mr. Putin or the oligarchs who support the Russian military. Josh, I'll start with you. An indication this is, I believe, of the new stance on Russia by the Biden administration, and indeed an orchestrated and unified stance against Russia.
Yeah, I think it's important to acknowledge the Trump administration was in some ways quite tough on Russia. They imposed sanctions on some of Russia's richest individuals. They approved lethal weapon sales to Ukraine. They fought hard against the Nord Stream 2 oil pipeline, a gas pipeline between Germany and Russia. The rhetoric from the Trump administration, particularly from the top, was a little softer. Trump had a kind of personal rapport or sort of personal rapport with President Putin, but their actual policy was reasonably tough. And in some ways, we're seeing a continuity of that from the Biden administration, who don't have a lot of affection for Russia. And so they are seeking to continue a tough stance on Russia. This stance will include tough rhetoric. It will include rhetoric about human rights which the Trump administration did not talk about really with regards to Russia, with the imprisonment of Alexei Navalny, an opposition leader in Russia, the Biden administration is seeking to respond specifically to that with added sanctions. So they're putting their might behind a human rights issue. And they are also, you know, pushing back against the Nord Stream 2 pipeline as well, although there is some concern that they're not pushing back hard enough. If you talk to some Eastern European countries, places like Estonia, who are very concerned about this pipeline and this connection between Germany and Russia, they feel the Americans could be doing more on Nord Stream. But they are pushing back and they are seeking to use sanctions to hurt the Russians in their pocketbooks.
And I'll go to you, JJ, with kind of the same question. We have sanctions here. And are these sanctions significant enough or strong enough to be a deterrent to the type of Russian action, this type of poisoning?
I think what we're seeing is strong enough, in part because a couple of the people that I've spoken to say something a little different from what Josh just mentioned about the Trump approach. While what we saw from Trump was not weak, but some of them say they weren't as strong as they could have been. One of the things that's very interesting is the FBI added Yevgeny Prigozhin, who is known as Putin's chef, to its most wanted list. As you may remember, he was indicted in 2018 for his role in the election meddling situation in 2016. You know, he is the person who essentially ran or runs the Internet Research Agency, which is responsible for a lot of the mayhem that took place. But he was just added to the most wanted list. And when you ask the FBI about that, they don't say anything about it. But what you hear is that, okay, this is a message to the Putin administration that we're going to put some teeth behind what we've said and done in the past. As far as Navalny goes, there's a writer by the name of Brett Bruen. Actually, he is the former global engagement director for the Obama administration White House. And he wrote a piece in the Business Insider a couple of weeks ago. And in that piece, he said there's a very real possibility that the Biden administration cannot restore America's reputation by seeming to be or trying to be tougher. And a part of the reason for that, he said, is because the world has moved on. During the Trump administration, the world doesn't believe that it can trust the U.S. So it may be an objective of the Biden administration to restore that reputation, but they may not be able to do it, especially in some of these situations where Russia and China and some of these other places that the U.S. and the world has problems with are continuing to do what they do.
Josh, I'll give you the last word on this subject. The Biden administration imposed sanctions on Russia. In the case of Saudi Arabia and Mohammed bin Salman, was deemed responsible for Khashoggi's death. According to declassified intelligence, there were no sanctions. What's the difference?
The difference is that Saudi Arabia is an ally of America and Russia is an adversary. And I think the Biden administration, although it wants to recalibrate relations with Saudi Arabia and has frozen some weapon sales, released this report that is clearly marks Mohammed bin Salman as being responsible for the death of Jamal Khashoggi. They weren't willing to impose sanctions on MBS himself. They have sanctioned some Saudis in relation to the information that was released, and they are banning certain Saudis from entering America, something called the Khashoggi ban that they've created. But they pulled back from sanctioning bin Salman because Saudi is an ally. They are an important energy provider. They're an important counterbalance to Iran in the region. And they're important in America's counterterrorism work in the Middle East. And so alienating its primary subject, Mohammed bin Salman, was thought to be a step too far by the Biden administration. Many liberals, in fact, are disappointed with them. They felt that they wanted them to go further to really make an example of MBS and his extrajudicial killing of Khashoggi, a sort of really unpleasant incident that happened back in 2018.
We will see what further responses look like down the road. Just very quickly, I wanted to get to you, JJ, and ask you a question about the Iraqi attack on a U.S. base where there's 10 rockets were targeted. Second attack on the U.S. forces in Iraq in a calendar month, the previous attack coming in northern Iraq, I believe, in February. Just very quickly, has anyone claimed responsibility, and do we know what the U.S. response would look like?
No, nobody's claimed responsibility for it because Iran is not going to do that. And they don't ever claim responsibility for these situations, even though they are not pulling the trigger. They're paying the people that pull the trigger in situations like this. I have a very good source at Al-Assad and had that source there for a long time. And I've been there myself, too. It is a sprawling, gigantic base. So these kind of attacks happen all the time. And it's not just Iran that's engaged in these attacks. There are ISIS forces there. There are other smaller militia groups that are there. But these particular ones are believed to have come from Iran, but it's not likely we'll hear them claim responsibility for it.
I want to move on to the COVID-19 update. We have great news again about the Johnson & Johnson vaccine being approved in the U.S., which requires only one shot instead of the two shots needed for the Pfizer and Moderna vaccines. President Biden saying that production is ahead of schedule, and we might even be on course for a semi-normal summer this year. So, Josh, I want to talk about the politics versus the science of loosening these restrictions. How politicians making the balance to do this when you have officials saying, please don't loosen these restrictions, but at the same time, they're making the decision to go ahead with it and using things like invoking freedom and personal choice as the justification for opening up their states and cities.
As a politician, this whole pandemic has been a process of balancing science and politics and balancing also the desire for economic freedoms and the cost of keeping things shut down, keeping bars and restaurants shut down for months and months at a time, and the loss of people's livelihoods. It isn't just a case of everyone go out and have a party. These businesses need to survive. So there are tough calls to be made. Having said that, it does seem like some governors, Greg Abbott of Texas, for example, are moving quite precipitously towards reopening and ending mask mandates. It may be a little soon. We've seen cases plummet in America in the last month, very reassuringly, but they have plateaued of late at a reasonably high level, about 60,000 cases a day. We are going into a warmer period, particularly down south in places like Texas. So it's a concern. You know, the vaccination effort is ramping up as we speak. We're seeing 1.5 million a day be vaccinated. These are good numbers, but there's still a huge amount of vaccine still to be put into people's arms. And it would be a shame to see what would amount to a fourth surge in the virus just as the vaccine is coming into play and we're rounding the final stretch, if you like. And that's the concern that the health officials have.
We just have a couple of minutes left, but I'd like to get a quick comment from each one of you, because you have such a broad knowledge of the global stage, about this unrest that is happening among authoritarian regimes around the world. You have police in Myanmar repeatedly using tear gas, rubber bullets against crowds. These violent protests are continuing there. You have a marathon bail hearing after the Chinese government rounded up hundreds of Hong Kong democracy activists. Again, another crackdown on dissent from Beijing. And you have U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken pressing the leader of Ethiopia to end hostilities in its Tigray region in the north, citing a growing number of credible reports of atrocities and human rights violations and abuses. I'm going to start with you, Josh. The U.S. retreated from the stage a bit during the Trump administration. Is the U.S. still going to be an effective player in stemming this surge of authoritarianism and reasserting democracy and peace around the world?
You know, it's difficult. The U.S., even at the height of its global power and global hegemony, isn't able to resolve every human rights issue in every country in the world. And places like Myanmar and Ethiopia are not necessarily countries where the U.S. is likely to intervene militarily, to really put its capital on the line to resolve human rights issues. Hong Kong is obviously a difficult one as well because, you know, it's really the purview of China, which is the US's strongest competitor and rival and adversary. Having said that, the Biden administration is committed to promoting human rights and promoting democracy far more so than the Trump administration. The real question is, do they have the will and the desire to do more than issue concerned statements and, you know, work some back channels and make the US's view clear? They can add sanctions to that, and they've shown some indication that they're willing to do that. But ultimately, when you look at the other things we've discussed today, domestic terrorism and extremism, the COVID pandemic, the economic crisis, all of these things are happening on American soil. Joe Biden is facing as difficult a domestic situation as really any president for 100 years, I would say.
And JD, we got about a minute. President Biden said that the U.S. is back on the global stage. Are they?
I think the U.S. is still effective and can and will be effective, but it's going to take a minute. It's going to take a while. We're only a month after the previous administration that you mentioned had a very different approach. So it's going to take a minute, but it can happen.
Well, you both handled a very difficult question in an incredibly short period of time. Kudos to you. Thank you. That is all the time we have. Thanks to our panelists, J.J. Green, national security correspondent for WTOP and host of Target USA, and Josh Glancy, Washington bureau chief for the Sunday Times. This program is produced by the Voice of America. I'm Michael Williams. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases especially written for people learning English. On today's program, you will hear stories from Alice Bryant, Dan Friedel, and Mario Ritter Jr. Later, Jill Robbins answers a question from a learner on this week's Ask a Teacher. We close with an American story. This week, we present part 3 of Edgar Allan Poe's William Wilson. But first, here are Alice and Dan.
The town of Bentonia, in the southern state of Mississippi, has fewer than 500 people. But it is known as the birthplace of a special style of blues music. One musician is doing what he can to keep the music and storytelling tradition alive. Jimmy Duck Holmes is 73 years old. He is the last remaining Bentonia blues musician. He was just nominated for a Grammy Award for Best Traditional Blues Album. The album is called Cypress Grove. Holmes hopes Cypress Grove will help save the Bentonia blues long after he is gone. The world has changed around Holmes and his Blue Front Cafe, the country's oldest surviving juke joint. Across the South, these spaces were historically owned and visited by African Americans. But many juke joints have closed as owners have passed away. Blues experts believe Holmes is the only American operating a juke joint passed down by his parents. The Grammy Awards take place this year on March 14th. Holmes plans to watch the say. He cannot go because of the coronavirus pandemic. Instead, he will be surrounded by musicians from across Mississippi who want to perform with him. I'll be here in this hole in the wall every day for as long as I can so that people don't forget, Holmes said. We're trying to make sure it doesn't die.
Holmes's parents opened Blue Front in 1948 when Holmes was just a baby. It was the first black-owned business in Bentonia. At the time, the town was mainly a community of black farmers. Holmes's parents, Carrie and Mary, were sharecroppers. Mary ran the Blue Front during the day, while Holmes worked with his father in the fields. By the time he was 9, Holmes was operating farming equipment by himself. The Holmes's business was a community gathering place. People came to have their clothing pressed, get a haircut, or buy salt, pepper, and other food products. And they came for the blues. Musicians stood in line outside, waiting to perform there. During cotton picking season, the Blue Front was open 24 hours a day to serve farm workers. They came in to eat Mary's famous buffalo fish. On weekends, people stayed all night drinking, dancing, and playing music. The town was never home to more than 600 people, but its location on the Illinois Central Railway brought visitors. Later, the only roadway between the southern cities of Memphis and Jackson passed through Bentonia. That made the town more popular. Historians who traveled through Mississippi to document blues musicians discovered Bentonia's style. Its use of minor key musical notes gave it a sound unlike the better known blues styles. Growing up, Holmes learned music from his neighbor, Henry Stuckey. Stuckey is known as the father of the Bentonia Blues. He was an aging World War I veteran and played music for Holmes and his 13 brothers and sisters. The Bentonia style is passed from one musician to the next. It cannot be learned through written music. The old-timers I learned from couldn't read, and they couldn't read sheet music, said Holmes, who also does not read music. Dan Auerbach produced Holmes's album Cypress Grove. He is also a member of the band The Black Keys. He said, "The beauty of Holmes's music is the improvisation. Those songs, they're like a living organism almost. They're changing daily," he said. "You can feel the realness and the immediacy of the music. And that's what makes it so special."
Today, a four-lane highway moves traffic away from Bentonia. Many businesses have closed down. Buildings have been torn down. More than 25% of the population lives below the poverty line. The train passes through town every day, but it does not stop. Holmes never imagined leaving Bentonia. He lives on the same farm where he was raised, about a kilometer and a half from the Blue Front Cafe. He has become Bentonia's biggest draw. Visitors come from all over the world to see him. They want to hear the music and learn the tradition. Before the pandemic, Mississippi musicians performed at the Blue Front every other Friday, sometimes more. They played different blues styles. Holmes holds Bentonia Blues workshops, and every day that he is at the Blue Front, he is willing to teach anyone who walks in. Some fans are surprised that he is so easy to reach, said Robert Connolly Farr. The Mississippi native, who now lives in Canada, has been visiting Holmes for guitar lessons for many years. Farr said, "I think it's important to Jimmy that this place is open and that it always has music and life in it." Holmes has performed in Europe, South America, and across the U.S. He opened for the Black Keys in Washington, D.C. in 2019. But he always comes back home. Holmes said that no young people in Bentonia want to learn the Bentonia style. They say it is too complex. They do not realize how every style of American music has roots in the blues, he said. But he keeps extra guitars around the blue front just in case someone wants to play. It will survive somehow, Holmes said as he sat in his empty juke joint. I learned enough that I was able to carry it on, and probably once I'm gone, somebody will be sitting around here playing, someone who picked up the things that I was doing. I have to hope. I have to hope. I'm Alice Bryant.
And I'm Dan Friedel.
The World Health Organization warns that 25% of the world's population, or 2.5 billion people, will have hearing problems by 2050. The warning came from the first ever report on hearing from the United Nations Health Agency. The report found that many of the causes of hearing loss are preventable. They include infections, disease, birth defects, too much noise, and lifestyle choices. To fight hearing loss, the report suggests measures which, it says, could cost what is equal to $1.33 for every person each year. WHO Director General Tedros Adhanom Ghebreyesus said the cost of doing nothing is very high, an estimated $1 trillion. The UN researchers estimate that 1 in 5 people around the world already have hearing problems. But the report warned the number may increase to 2.5 billion people during the next 30 years. And 700 million would require some kind of treatment for hearing loss by 2050. The UN experts say in the report that many people with hearing loss cannot get care. This is especially a problem in poor countries where there are fewer health care professionals. 80% of people with hearing loss live in poor countries. The report finds that, among those countries, 78% have fewer than one ear, nose, and throat specialist for every million people. The numbers are similar for specialists who treat hearing, speech therapists, and teachers for the deaf. The report adds that even in rich countries, the ability to get hearing treatment is uneven. It said there is a lack of good information and a stigma surrounding hearing problems that prevents people from getting treatment. Even among healthcare providers, knowledge relevant to prevention, early identification and management of hearing loss and ear disease is commonly lacking. The report proposes active measures for solving the problem. It recommends public health campaigns aimed at reducing loud noise. It also calls for increased vaccinations against diseases like meningitis, which have been linked to hearing loss. Other recommendations include systematic examination of people to identify problems at different points in their lives. For example, the report notes that 60% of hearing problems in children could be prevented. Programs to identify possible problems that target new mothers and babies can help too. In addition, recent technological improvements, including easy-to-use tools, can identify ear disease and hearing loss at any age. It is now easier to carry out screening in difficult conditions like those found during the coronavirus health crisis and in underserved areas of the world. I'm Mario Ritter, Jr.
This week, we answer a question from Ali in Iran. He wrote to us after reading a previous Ask a Teacher about security and safety. Dear VOA, could you explain the grammar related to the word "its" in this sentence?
Security often has to do with a group's efforts to protect its members from harm.
Dear Ali, thank you for writing to us. In the sentence you read, the word "its" is a possessive adjective, meaning belonging to it. And the "it" in this sentence is the group. Other possessive adjectives are words like his, her, my, your, our, and their. These words appear before a noun, like most adjectives in English, and change the meaning of the noun. Here is another example of how to use "its."
I cannot drive that car. Its tires are flat. The queen wears a beautiful crown. Its jewels shine in the sun.
We can use words like "its" to take the place of a noun, as in this example.
I have large eyes, and so does my dog. Mine are blue, and its are brown.
Many English learners confuse the possessive form "its" with the short form "its," it apostrophe s. The short form "its" is what we call a contraction. "Its" can be the short form of the word "it is" or "it has." Here are some examples where "its" is the short form of "it is."
It's great to see you again. I think it's time for dinner.
Compare these sentences with "its" as the short form of "it has."
It's been years since I met with my high school friends. With daily practice, it's gotten easier for them to speak English.
I hope this helps you understand the different ways we use "its," Ali. And that's Ask a Teacher. What question do you have about American English? Send us an email at learningenglish@voanews.com. I'm Jill Robbins.
William Wilson, Part 3.
You remember that in the last part of my story, I told of my experiences in my first school. I spoke of my early meetings with a boy who looked and behaved as I did, whose name was even the same as mine, William Wilson. I told of the night when I went to Wilson's room with a plan to hurt him. What I saw that night so frightened me that I left the room and the school forever. As I stood looking down at his sleeping form and face, I might have been looking at myself in a looking-glass. It was not like this, surely not like this, that he appeared in the daytime. The same name, the same face, the same body, the same day of coming to school, and then his use of my way of walking, my manner of speaking. Was it in truth humanly possible that what I now saw was the result, and the result only, of his continued efforts to be like me? Afraid, I left the old school and never entered it again. After some months at home, doing nothing, I went to study at the famous school called Eton. I had partly forgotten my days at the other school, or at least my feelings about those days had changed. The truth, the terrible truth of what had happened there, was gone. Now I doubted what I remembered. Now I called the subject into my mind only to smile at the strength of the strange ideas and thoughts I had once had. My life at Eton did not change this view. The fool's life into which I carelessly threw myself washed away everything that was valuable in my past. I do not wish, however, to tell here the story of my wrongdoing, wrongdoing which went against every law of the school and escaped the watchful eyes of all the teachers. 3 years of this had passed, and I had grown much larger in body and smaller in soul. 3 years of wrongdoing had made me evil. One night I asked a group of friends who were as evil as I to come to a secret meeting in my room. We met at a late hour. There was strong drink, and there were games of cards, loud talking until the new day began appearing in the east. Warm with the wine and with the games of chance, I was raising my glass to drink in honor of some especially evil idea when I heard the voice of a servant outside the room. He said that someone had asked to speak with me in another room. I was delighted. A few steps brought me into the hall of the building. In this room no light was hanging, but I could see the form of a young man about my own height, wearing clothes like those I myself was wearing. His face I could not see. When I had entered, he came quickly up to me, and taking me by the arm, he said softly in my ear, "William Wilson." There was something in the manner of the stranger and in the trembling of his uplifted finger which made my eyes open wide. But it was not this which had so strongly touched my mind and heart. It was the sound of those two simple, well-known words, William Wilson, which reached into my soul. Before I could think again and speak, he was gone. For some weeks I thought about this happening. Who and what was this Wilson? Where did he come from? And what were his purposes? I learned that for family reasons he had suddenly left the other school on the afternoon of the day I myself had left it. But in a short time I stopped thinking about the subject. I gave all my thoughts to plans for study at Oxford University. There I soon went. My father and mother sent me enough money to live like the sons of the richest families in England. Now my nature showed itself with double force. I threw aside all honor. Among those who spent too much money, I spent more, and I added new forms of wrongdoing to the older ones already well known at the university. And I fell still lower. Although it may not be easily believed, it is a fact that I forgot my position as a gentleman. I learned and used all the evil ways of those men who live by playing cards. Like such skilled gamblers, I played to make money. My friends trusted me, however. To them, I was the laughing but honorable William Wilson, who freely gave gifts to anyone and everyone, who was young and who had some strange ideas, but who never did anything really bad. For 2 years I was successful in this way. Then a young man came to the university, a young man named Glendinning, who, people said, had quickly and easily become very rich. I soon found him of weak mind. This, of course, made it easy for me to get his money by playing cards. I played with him often. At first, with the gambler's usual skill, I let him take money from me. Then my plans were ready. I met him one night in the room of another friend, Mr. Preston. A group of 8 or 10 persons were there. By my careful planning, I made it seem that it was chance that started us playing cards. In fact, it was Glendinning himself who first spoke of a card game. We sat and played far into the night, and at last the others stopped playing. Glendinning and I played by ourselves while the others watched. The game was the one I liked best, a game called Ecarte. Glendinning played with a wild nervousness that I could not understand, though it was caused partly, I thought, by all the wine he had been drinking. In a very short time he had lost a great amount of money to me. Now he wanted to double the amount for which we played. This was as I had planned, but I made it seem that I did not want to agree. At last I said yes. In an hour he had lost 4 times as much money as before. For some reason his face had become white. I had thought him so rich that losing money would not trouble him, and I believed this whiteness, this paleness, was the result of drinking too much wine. Now, fearing what my friends might say about me, I was about to stop the game when his broken cry and the wild look in his eyes made me understand that he had lost everything he owned. Weak of mind and made weaker by wine, he should never have been allowed to play that night. But I had not stopped him. I had used his condition to destroy him. The room was very quiet. I could feel the icy coldness in my friends. What I would have done I cannot say, for at that moment the wide, heavy doors of the room were suddenly opened. Every light in the room went out. But I had seen that a man entered. He was about my own height, and he was wearing a very fine long coat. The darkness, however, was now complete, and we could only feel that he was standing among us. Then we heard his voice. In a soft, low, never-to-be-forgotten voice, which I felt deep in my bones, he said, "Gentlemen, I am here only to do my duty. You cannot know the true character of the man who has tonight taken a large amount of money from Mr. Glendinning. Please have him take off his coat, and then look in it very carefully." While he was speaking, there was not another sound in the room, And as he ended, he was gone.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.